Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, I'm Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Today, once again, we're joined by Christopher Thornburg. He is the founding partner of Beacon Economics. Dr. Thornburg is an expert in the study of regional economies, real estate dynamics, labor markets, and business forecasting. Prior to launching Beacon, he worked with the UCLA Anderson Forecast, where he regularly authored the Outlooks for California. He received his PhD in business economics from the Anderson School at UCLA and is currently teaching the MBA program at UC San Diego. Dr. Thornburg, we welcome you back.
Great to be here.
Real estate prices tripled between 97 and 2005. How has the homeowner in California reacted to having all this excess equity and potential spending power?
They've been spending lots of it. When you look at consumer spending has been rising very strongly over the last 5-6 years, much faster, in fact, than overall income, just disposable income. One of the results of that, of course, is that savings rate, which was already at a pretty low level in the mid-90s, somewhere around 4% of disposable income, has actually gone to negative territory. People are actually spending more than their disposable income. And again, that's driven by home appreciation. And specifically, I mean, you don't have to go too far. Estimates of mortgage equity withdrawals at one point in time in 2005-2006 was up to something on the order of 8% of consumer spending. So that's, of course, a mortgage equity withdrawal. It's simply just taking some of that equity directly out of your home, you know, borrowing against your home and going out and spending that money.
Well, this has been a pretty historic price increase. Has the residual been that California families are more financially stable, or do we just own more stuff?
Well, that's a real good question. Financially stable. I mean, certainly for some of those mortgage equity withdrawals were used to pay off other types of debt, such as, for example, credit card debt, other forms of revolving debt. What you're seeing over the last few months, though, of course, is a reverse of that situation. Now that the housing market's turned the other direction, a lot of people are suddenly finding that appreciation has not occurred. Hence, that mortgage they picked up a few years ago, you know, that subprime with a 2-year introductory rate, before they've been able to kind of rotate that around. Now, you go 2 years to hit your reset, but by that point in time, your house is up 15% in value, so you simply refinance, and away you go. This is a source of limitless consumption. Well, of course, that can't possibly be. Prices can't continue to rise at that pace forever. A lot of people right now are in difficult financial situations, and you're seeing that in terms of rising debt elsewhere on the balance books, primarily in the revolving debt credit cards.
Okay. An offshoot of that, the bankruptcy law has changed. Is that going to make it more difficult for people just to walk away from what they got themselves into in the future?
Now there are some income testing in the bankruptcy laws, which means that you can't just walk away free and clear if you're making a certain amount of income that can be used to pay off some of your debt. So yeah, that definitely it's going to be harder for people to escape, so to speak. But of course, if you are in true financial straits, the bankruptcy laws are still there to protect you.
Even though the income is there?
Yeah. Well, again, there's an income testing. What they're going to do is they're going to look at your debt relative to your income, and if your income is sufficient to pay off some of that debt, the courts will require you to carry a portion of that. You're not going to be able to just walk away from everything free and clear.
Right. In California, the test is the median income, which I don't think you could, well, maybe just recently you could get a loan even if you had a median income. But in other words, most homeowners would almost have to earn the median income of California and therefore be stuck with some of their residual debt, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting also, like, for example, there's lots of little weird things happening out there. One of the big things facing people, let's say, for example, you did buy a home in the last year. Price of that home's going down. You had 100% loan to value. You go to the bank and you say, look, you know, the mortgage is worth more than the house. I'm not going to pay this. And the bank says, okay, go away. Don't worry about it. You know, you can walk away from the situation. Let's say that the residual after you sell the home, let's say there was $50,000 in mortgage debt that you didn't pay off that the bank forgives you. Well, guess what? The $50,000, that's taxable income. So if the bank lets you get away with it, you still got that tax bill at the end of the year.
What's interesting is a lot of people think that that is a lender decision to inform the IRS, which, of course, it is not. The IRS isn't about to be cut out of their chunk because some lender policy decides not to tell them.
Yeah, that's probably true. I'm sure they'll be keeping an eye out for this sort of stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
In 97, I wrote a report talking about the prices of California exploding. That prediction went to January of 2005, at which point I said real estate had topped out. As it turned out, that was 8 months too soon, and I took a lot of heat for being 8 months too early. Did UCLA experience a similar fate when it came out with some things that took a while to prove to be true?
Absolutely. I mean, you got to be very careful. A lot of people said that for a number of years that, the forecast is crazy because they keep talking about bubbles and prices are rising. Well, when we first came out in 2003 and said, we don't like the looks of this market, you're seeing rapid amount of appreciation in a market where you used to see none. This is a bubble-like situation. At the time, of course, a lot of people sort of poo-pooed that. We didn't really call the end of it at that point in time. The one thing about a bubble is, by definition, it's very hard to see when it's going to end. Now, me personally, I called for the end of this about the same time you did. I was looking for basically the end of early 2005, the end of 2004. I didn't think things could really get so much further than it actually did. Actually, prices didn't stop rising till probably the first part of 2006. Now, of course, hindsight being 2020, what I recognize now is that we have had this sort of world-class real estate bubble because of the mortgage markets. A lot of people are looking at the mortgage markets and are saying, these markets are the reason the bubble popped. Well, you got to be cautious. These mortgage markets are the reason the bubble got so big.
Exactly.
You go back to past cycles, and there was a much more personal relationship between the investor and the investee, between the home buyer and the lender. And there came a point in time where the lender would say to the person who wants to buy a home, I'm sorry, your income is not big enough for me to feel comfortable lending you this money. And that was when the bubble ended. But that personal relationship has been removed in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, securitization has been the new thing and has been that financial instrument which has revolutionized the market. But by revolutionizing the market, what you've done is you've really cut loose any kind of basic logic about who should be borrowing what. And as a result, pretty much anybody who wanted to buy a home for pretty much any price could get that money, thus giving this market an additional boost that we've never seen before. So don't feel bad. I mean, again, I don't think a lot of economists out there recognize what was happening at the time, because in many ways the mortgage industry was very busy hiding it from us. They didn't want us to know. But of course, eventually the truth was going to be revealed. These are the kind of things, this pyramid scheme kind of aspect to this market that just couldn't last.
Were the people that were purchasing the mortgages and securitizing them, were they really aware of the lack of qualification that was going on?
Well,
or did they just not care?
You mean the people buying the bonds?
The whole chain where it goes and gets bought in a pool and securitized and the bonds. Did anybody actually know that these guys were being able to borrow $1 million without any proof of basically anything?
There were certainly discussions of that, but, it was very difficult to pick out. The thing was, is the people who are supposed to be monitoring this is the Moody's, the S&P's, the guys who rate these bonds. They were rating them AAA.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to deal with this, and so their knee-jerk reaction was, well, let's just give it the best rating possible.
Well, now, the way they rate things, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, is past performance, too. So everything was working as long as prices went up, and so, where you're headed can be much different than where you are right now.
Absolutely.
It was working, and so they get the AAA, and now it probably would get an F if there was such a thing.
If you're looking at a bond that has a life of, 10, 20, 30 years, you can't just look at the here and now. I mean, we know that real estate prices have these big cycles, these periods of appreciation followed by periods of depreciation. If you're rating a 30-year bond, you have to be able to take that into account. I think that they were thinking that the sort of portfolio aspect of this, the fact that, the top 85% of these tranches were very well diversified and seemed to be immune from the risk, gave them this kind of status. But again, there was this sort of lack of realization that by breaking the link between the lender and the lendee, that the kind of lending that was going on was just functionally, incredibly irresponsible.
Okay. You know, we're sort of in the predicting business. Do you feel that all real estate booms are similar in that they are emotionally driven until they reach a breaking point?
Oh, I would say so. I mean, when you talk about any bubble, whether we're talking stocks or houses or ostriches or whatever you want to call, it's the same basic idea. That is to say that people forget about the fundamentals and are buying strictly on the basis of the expectation that somebody else is going to buy it at a higher price.
Okay.
So, and in that kind of world, in that kind of mentality, prices functionally have no limit because people are just willing to keep throwing money at it until some point in time where, you know, things are just so out of whack that you can't get financing for it anymore.
Is there a common breaking point? So when you have, let's say, the end of a boom in somewhere around 89 and 90 and 80 and 2005, looking back, can we look at, oh, they all had something in common as far as a statistic?
You know, I've looked for that magic number. I haven't found it.
Okay.
I really haven't. It's a difficult thing to see. And, of course, this time is not like these past markets. These past markets, you had a circumstance in which so the price-to-income ratio hit a certain level before it turned around. And that, of course, is representative of that banker, that person out there lending that money going, I'm not going to lend you this money on the basis of your income. And that's sort of the functional top of these markets. This time, that top didn't exist. In fact, we really only had the withdrawal of credit not as a function of tightening credit standards due to, say, income-to-price ratios, but rather this time the real breakdown of the market occurred just because the rate of problems in those mortgage markets, and I'm talking delinquencies and foreclosures, had gotten to the point that they just couldn't be ignored anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when investors started realizing, wow, these products, these mortgage-backed securities are being sold. These aren't as wonderful as we're being told. These are incredibly high-risk products because there are lots and lots of people out there who have loans they just shouldn't have.
Absolutely. All right, what are the domino effects that once we reach this emotional breaking point where we realize this is not going to be sold at a higher price to someone else, what are the domino effects that we now see, and let's say in ways of declining volume of sales and also maybe even unemployment, that type of thing? What are the usual dominoes that fall once this has occurred?
Right. Well, as you point out, when these markets bust, there's sort of a distinct pattern of things that happen. First thing that happens, sales go down. We know that. That was mid to late 2005, depending on where in the U.S. you're looking at, perhaps even early 2006. That's when sales start falling off. That's the beginning of the end. That's when people are just starting to realize that these markets are not what they're cracked up to be. It's also slightly representative of credit tightening because people can't get money to buy homes. Sales start to fall. And then 6 to 9 months later, that's when prices basically top off. And sure enough, about the middle of 2006 is when prices flattened out. Stock didn't fall immediately, but then we didn't expect it would, only that they would top out at that particular point in time. Then after that, the market kind of goes into stall mode, and then after a certain amount of time, the lack of equity creation eventually spills over and starts impacting consumer spending. When consumer spending starts pulling back, well, that, of course, is a big problem for the economy. You know, consumers drive the economy. They're 70% of the overall economy. Even a couple percent decline in consumer spending ripples throughout the economy, has a tremendous impact. That's the next step. That will slow the economy down. And that's when you see unemployment start to rise. And that, of course, is when you get prices starting to fall and waves of foreclosures. This time is a little different on the back end. Very similar on the front end. We saw first a decline in sales. Then we saw prices flattening out. But this time, consumer spending, it continues to be fairly decent. You know, it hasn't been growing at the same pace, but it's still maintained. Part of that is because there's so much equity out there that's creating kind of a cushion.
Mm-hmm.
But the mortgage markets are so bad that you're starting to see the wave of foreclosure starting already. You're starting to see prices decline already. And, of course, that's going to feed in and make the hit to consumers that much worse when it does, in fact, hit. So a little reverse in the back end because of the peculiar nature of the mortgage cycle this time.
When you look out for a few years, what would let you know the worst is over?
You mean when do I think we've reached the bottom?
Well, just what statistic do you keep an eye on and saying, okay, there we go. Now,
yeah.
And it'll be when the mood is the worst, but you can go, okay, now we know at least we're going to slowly be headed in the right direction.
Yeah, I pay a lot of attention, of course, to prices. And I, you know, prices have started to fall in California. My guess is they're going to continue to fall for at least the next couple of years. I think we're due for perhaps even on the order of a 20% decline in prices in the state. Now, that's going to take a couple of years to work its way out of the system. That's one way to take a look at that. When prices stop falling, that'll be a good sign we're at the bottom of the market. Another good thing to take a look at would be permits. Builders obviously have to be forward-thinking, particularly in a state like California where it takes you so long to go from, you know, getting the lot prepared to getting the permit to getting the product actually built. When permits start to rise, that's a good sign that the softness is starting to go away. And, you know, builders are very optimistic people. They're always looking ahead. As soon as they feel a little bit of ground under their feet, they're going to start pushing forward because they know a couple of years down the line, things are going to bounce. But, you know, we got a couple of bad years ahead of us.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Okay. We talked last time about subprime lenders closing their doors and leaving some investor holding the bag. And then you mentioned something that little concerns. I wanted to maybe expand on that a little bit, that you thought that many of us may inadvertently own a portion of those bad investments.
Absolutely.
How do we get involved in stuff we don't even know we own?
Well, again, remember what's been happening. We've had this massive process of securitization. You bundle up billions and billions of dollars worth of mortgages. Those are tranched off and sold as mortgage-backed securities. Wall Street's been making a mint on these for the last few years. And there's even sort of secondary markets. You know, people will buy up the lower tranches, package those up, and sell them off just as bonds, yet again, collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, those are known as. This kind of process has been huge in Wall Street. And, of course, where do these bonds end up? Well, it could end up in your portfolio. You go look at where your money is and what your portfolio manager is investing in. Lots of pensions, lots of insurance companies have been buying these things. At the time, they look like a nice, safe investment with a good rate of return, and it was a good thing to buy. It's, you know, a good, solid rate of return out of relatively what we thought was a relatively low-risk product. Of course, as we know now, the risk is much greater. You know, one thing you have to do is take a look at that ABX. That ABX, of course, is the market which tracks the sort of market price for these mortgage-backed securities.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at this yesterday. Every single index in the ABX is at an all-time low right now, and it's even spilling up into the A's and double A's. So that's the kind of situation we're in right now.
It used to be, let's say I'm a lender, loan somebody $400,000, have to foreclose on it someday, and I sell it for $350,000, so I get a $50,000 loss. That was the extent of my leverage. When you're dealing with these other types of investments, the CDOs and so forth, is the leverage much greater than one-on-one?
No, that's about right. I mean, the worst that can happen is the value of your bond goes away. But, you know, we're talking billions and billions and billions of dollars. And a lot of these bonds, don't forget, are held by overseas investors. You know, one of the big questions, of course, is when is the Fed going to loosen? When is that interest rate going to start falling so that we can expect some support in the market? And I have to caution people that even if the Fed starts to loosen, it doesn't mean mortgage rates are going to go down. In fact, quite the opposite. It seems likely to me that mortgage rates are going to go up. What's going to happen, of course, is the securitization process is going to start breaking down. Foreign investors, even domestic investors, are going to start looking at these products with an eye of extreme skepticism. They start backing off. Of course, that means the price of those bonds falls, which is in essence the same thing as saying interest rates are rising. So it's very possible that we're already seeing a spread between the sort of riskless and risky assets, and that's going to put additional pressure on those housing markets. This has got a ways to go, a lot of unwinding to do.
I've heard that the optimistic people say that the demographics are such that will solve the problem. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't know what they mean by that, this quote-unquote demographic argument. The fact is population growth has been slowing in the United States for any number of years, and on top of that, we have the largest excess supply of homes. No matter how you measure it, if you look at the pace of building relative to population growth, if you look at the excess inventory, right now inventory's at a record high. Everything says we have way too much supply of homes and just not enough people out there who can afford to buy them.
Well, it's interesting.
It's irrelevant.
California Association of Realtors in their magazine that they send their brokers. Last month, this was the cover story. It had said affordability. And then inside the story said that there was a group of people that came to the conclusion, and this was just very recently, that California's problems as far as the number of sales and so forth are directly attached to the California builder not building enough homes. And I just thought that was a rather amazing statement. And, of course, they mean affordable housing, but affordable housing isn't going to be built in California because the land is too high. In the past, we got back to affordable housing by a price decline. Do you expect we're headed there again?
Well, let me take you a step further. We do have a massive housing shortage in California, but as you point out, it's really a lack of apartments, and we do have a desperate lack of apartments. You can still build affordable apartments in California as long as you allow density. That's the whole key. If you pack lots of apartments on a piece of land, you can make that land affordable no matter how expensive it is. Of course, the problem here is that no community allows that kind of densification. They all fight it tooth and nail. And as a result of that, yeah, we do have a massive housing shortage at the low end of the scale. But that has nothing to do with the high-end condo markets and the housing markets, in Sacramento, the $800,000, 3,500 square foot home. That's not in that market. That's not affected by that. So, again, I know this number. I study these numbers, and it's really not – the crowding at the low end of the market is not relevant for what's happening at the top end of the market.
What headline tomorrow morning would have you saying, uh-oh, that's going to change my projections?
My projections are already pretty bad. So you mean, in a good way or in a bad way?
No, probably in a bad way. In other words, one thing that's a wild card that you go, oh, we really didn't need to see that, but now that it's here.
Yeah. I have two things I'm really keeping an eye on right now. One is consumer spending. If the last retail sales number came out, it wasn't good.
That's correct.
But the markets are fascinating. The markets are grasping at straws. We get a number from Walmart that's pretty positive, right, that their existing store sales are up by a good number. And everybody goes crazy. The stock market leaps to record highs, and everybody says, see, everything's wonderful. And then the day after, we get the retail sales number, which is horrifyingly bad. and everybody says, everybody kind of ignores that. And it's fascinating to me how no one's looking at what's really happening, the real trend. The real trend, of course, is that consumers are starting to slow their spending down, and that's going to continue to have a slowing effect on the overall U.S. economy, which will translate through to even worse markets. Now, the faster consumers pull back on their spending, the worse this cycle is going to be. So, if I see a couple more bad months in retail sales, I'm looking for a recession by fourth quarter of this year. Recession by the fourth quarter of this year would be very bad in a market that's already highly stressed due to the mortgage situation. On top of those already, mortgage products people can't afford, now throw in rising unemployment, throw in income growth that basically stalls, and you just have a mess on your hands.
Probably down to our last question, because it might take a couple minutes to answer. Recessions and their effect on commercial real estate.
Well, of course, commercial real estate is like residential real estate. I mean, it's a function of supply and demand. And so the question is where are we on the supply and demand front? Supply-wise, of course, we really have not been building, in part because we had so much excess supply after the 2001 downturn. You're still seeing fairly solid rents. Rents are going up in large part because there's more and more competition for tight bay space. Corporate profits, very, very high right now. Corporations want nicer space, so they're all competing for that good stuff, the stuff in the best part of town, and rents are being driven up.
Okay.
There are lots of vacancies out there, though.
Okay. We have about 30 seconds or so. Sure. Go out 3 years from now.
Okay.
Will those spaces be more likely vacant and demand less dollar per square foot?
I think there's a fair amount of stability in the commercial markets, with maybe the exception of the retail markets, where there's lots of supply out there. But I do think that there's going to be some hit, primarily due to not excess supply this time, but of course because basically a slowdown in demand. So yeah, they'll take a hit, but it's not going to be as bad as the residential side.
Okay, Christopher, I've really enjoyed these interviews, and hopefully we can do it again another day.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
All right.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.